The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
It's the 25th anniversary year for the Charleston Festival, a 10-day jamboree that takes place deep in the Sussex countryside. The venue is Charleston House, one-time home of Bloomsbury Group members Duncan Grant and Vanessa Bell, who moved here in 1916 and began to decorate it themselves in their own very particular style, with painted walls and murals and fabulous screens and a walled garden designed by Roger Fry. In 1980, it was taken over by the Charleston Trust, who restored it and opened it to the public in the summer, kicking off with the festival. I'm here to chair two events, Ian McEwan talking about his novel In Progress, The Children's Act, and Helen Dunmore and Mark Bostridge discussing the First World War. But first, I've arrived at the front door. Hello.
My name's Darren Clark, and I'm the head of curatorial services at Charleston.
Is this the front door? It's got quite a lot of doors.
It is. This is the front door, and along the side there is the kitchen door. So if you are delivering goods to the kitchen, you'd go there. But if you are visiting the family, you come to the front door.
So should we go and have a look inside? So we come into a rather nice terracotta tiled hall. Is all this furniture original furniture?
Yep, it's all original to the house. When Duncan Grant died in 1978, Angelica Garnett, his and Vanessa Bell's daughter, also Quentin Bell, gave a lot of the furniture and the fittings to the Charleston Trust. So you can see the house exactly as it is when the artist lived here. And a lot of the things you see were incorporated in the artist's work, in their paintings and designs.
And there's sort of quite a bit of wit you can see. There's a Buddha sitting on a table here with a glass necklace round his neck.
That's to evil eye, to keep away bad spirits. When they went on holiday, they did a lot of spending. There were jokes within the family that Vanessa Bell, when she came back from holiday, trunk loads of stuff would arrive, china and textiles and all sorts of things that she'd bought. And her sons, Julian Bell, went and taught in China in the 1930s and sent back a lot of things to his mother.
There are lots of people going around the house. It's got lots of corridors and different doors, so you can chase groups around the house, can't you, and not actually coincide with them.
That's right. It looks like just a normal small farmhouse on the outside, but actually there's 10 rooms that we show to the public, and there's lots of corridors, and it does go on and on and on for quite a while.
So while the other group goes into the dining room, where are we going to go?
We're going to go into Clive Bell's study, which is right at the front of the house in the centre, looking out over the pond.
Very recognisable pictorial style. Lots of yellow walls, blue picture rail, green sort of hand-painted bit above the picture rail, and lots of pictures that seem, almost the people in the pictures seem dimly recognisable to me.
This is what we call Clive Bell's study. So in later years, he wrote his autobiographies and his works here. But this was the first room that that Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant decorated when they moved here in 1916. And one of the last rooms that Duncan Grant decorated before he died in 1978. So it's like the whole history of Charleston in one room, with their decorations under the windowsill, Vanessa Bell's decorations around the fireplace.
It's a really wonderful fireplace, isn't it? If you think how incredibly unusual it must have seemed at the time. I mean, it seems familiar to us now, but to hand paint a fireplace like that must have been very avant-garde.
It was. This one was done in the 1920s, so they'd been designing since 1912. They'd worked with the Omega Workshops, designing textiles and furniture and all sorts of designs. And by the 1920s and 30s, they were, as well as fine artists, they were designers doing whole interiors for clients. So there were quite a few painted fireplaces and panels surviving from those schemes.
Do the books belong to them as well?
Most of these books do. These would have been Clive Bell's books. We have most of the books in the house are original, though some were bought later or lent, given by family members. Let's go up to the top studio, Vanessa Bell's studio.
lovely creeping, creaky door there. Oh, the fabulous, fabulous view of the garden.
In 1939, Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant made Charleston their primary home again. Between the wars, it was very much a place to come in the summer. But with the advent of war, did lots of changes to Charleston. So Vanessa Bell had this attic room turned into her studio, had a lovely big window put in with views right across the Weald.
Except for there's a big white marquee in the way of
there
it
is,
at this moment.
For the next couple of weeks. But she would come up after breakfast every day and work up here. And the place would have been full of art, just as it is now. This is our collection store.
And you've left the windowsills, it looks like, covered with sort of the marks where her paint pots and things went, or is that artful interior design?
No, that is original. When the house was restored in the 80s, as much as the original fabric was maintained, it had deteriorated quite a lot, so a lot was replaced and a lot is facsimile, but up here, these bits are original. We've just embarked on a project of cataloguing a large collection of works that were given to us by Angelica Garnett in 2008, before she died. 8,000 works altogether, sketchbooks, works on paper, canvases, huge designs for different projects. And we've got a series of interns over the next 3 years that are going to be photographing, cataloguing and digitising that collection. We just started that project. So they get to work up here. Very special, I think.
Right, where are we now?
So this is Duncan Grant's bedroom. This is the bedroom he had from 1916 when they moved to Charleston until he died in 1978. And soon after they moved in, Vanessa Bow decorated the room for him. So she painted the door panels. There are doors either side of the fireplace. So she painted lovely still lives in the top panel and a kind of abstract design in the bottom. And then also the fireplace around again.
Very so small bed.
It's bigger than most in the house. And it's quite a modern bed. So the house is set as it would have looked like in the 1950s and 60s, when all the key people that lived here were here, when all the key decorations had been done. And there was a real strong memory of Quentin Bauer and his wife Olivia and also Angelica. There was a recording of what the contents looked like, where everything was, and there was photographic information as well. So we sort of look at it like the 1950s. So here we are in the spare bedroom, and this was decorated by Vanessa Bell and her daughter Angelica in the 1930s. And Vanessa Bell wrote to Duncan Grant saying that it was a bit over the top, but as nobody was going to stay here too long, it shouldn't matter. Sort of lavender walls with pink arches and marbled columns.
They spent an awful lot of time painting the house rather than painting their own artworks.
They were at Charleston for 60 years, so it's not too bad. A few days of work to do this room. It wouldn't have taken forever.
And in between the two rooms, there's a painting of their servant. Is that right? Their housekeeper?
Their housekeeper, yeah, Grace Higgins. She lived upstairs in the attic with her husband, and she had her son here as well. And she stayed with the family. She looked after Duncan Grant until 1971 when she retired.
So this is the downstairs garden room.
The room where you would come to after dinner for your coffee and cigarettes and cigars and brandy and talk and maybe gossip. And it's decorated at the end of the Second World War, 1945. It was a lovely soft grey background, and on top of that there's some grey paisley patterns with white flowers. A sense of the end of the war, a sense of peacefulness and calmness. This will be where they hung all the best paintings, so we unfortunately only have a copy of a Picasso now made by Quentin Bauer before the original was sold. But the original Picasso was bought by Vanessa Bell and Clive Bell in 1911, one of the first to be in private ownership in the UK. And we've got Vanessa Bell's early work from 1909, Iceland Poppets, which is a beautiful still life, very serene.
What I hadn't realised was how much of a work in progress the house is. So it developed over years and years and years.
Very much so. In the beginning, during the First World War, Duncan Grant and David Garnett were out working on the farm most of the time. And so Vanessa Bell did a lot of the decoration. And at the end of the war, they weren't sure if they were going to keep Charleston on. It was in the middle of nowhere. It was very difficult to keep staff. You know, there was no running water, no electricity, no telephone. But in the end, they decided they would take a long lease out. And they were able to keep it as a family home all the way through their lives.
genetics except to powder her nose, but then she had her father's nose. She was talking of her contemporaries, how she had spoken last week with Hemingway, and how Ernest had said, "When I reach for my gun, I hear the word culture." How easy it seemed for them, she thought, and how hard it was for her. For she must always be asking, what is life like? Life is like... life is just... a bowl of cherries? No, someone else had said that. Besides, it was false to the whole nature of reality. Some of her books disappointed, vitiated by her intense feminism. Virginia was never a suffragette. She subscribed to the theory that the pen was mightier than the sword, and I once saw Evelyn Waugh reel under a savage blow from her Parker 51.
The inimitable Alan Bennett regaling his audience with a left-field view of Virginia Woolf. This is just one of many festivals a literary editor like me attends every year. Poor us, some might say. There are now hundreds on our islands alone, from the major ones, such as the grandly titled Edinburgh International Books Festival, to tiny ones, such as my own local in Stoke Newington, North London. I was in Sussex to introduce Ian McEwan.
Now, I have a confession to make to open this, which is that I haven't read this book, but neither have you. I did ask the publisher, and it's with the lawyers, which is interesting, and I think that we might want to interrogate that a little bit further.
Yeah, Random House lawyers are combing it for libel and invasion of privacy. And I'm in the clear. It's fine now. It's all fine.
Ian is one of those rare writers who has become a news story. So when the rumour went out that this book was about to be published and what it was about, you know, that you have news reporters scurrying around trying to find out what it is. We identified Siamese twins as one of the themes, but you will be the first people to actually hear a reading from it.
Second. I read it yesterday at my old university, Sussex. It's about a High Court judge, Fiona May, 59 years old, marriage in crisis, and she's duty judge. Until I started thinking about this, I hadn't realised that when you get nominated as duty judge, you're usually on duty for a week, which means you take calls day and night, often from people who urgently need some kind of resolution. Could be a newspaper. In this case, it's a hospital trust. And the hospital trust is seeking leave, as they say, to treat a 17-year-old boy who urgently needs a blood transfusion. Now, he and his parents are devout Jehovah's Witnesses, and as you know, most Jehovah's Witnesses will not allow themselves to be transfused by blood, and they draw on both Genesis and Leviticus and Acts, various texts, which they take loosely to suggest that God has proscribed the taking of blood into your own. Jehovah's Witnesses conveniently are able to change. They have more room for maneuver, say, than the Pope, because they say that God only slowly reveals his intentions. And if they wish to undo this prescription on blood transfusion, they can persuade themselves, which is an important human process, that in fact God has now let it be known that they were wrong in the past and they'd misinterpreted, and now they can go ahead. Now, in the English and Welsh jurisdiction, treating an adult against his or her will is trespass against the person. So no hospital will treat a person who's refusing treatment without some overriding decision of a court. I got rather absorbed in the whole business of what judges in the family division do. And in the opening chapters, I touch on a few other cases that Fiona May deals with. And here she's reflecting on a case that's made some impact on her state of mind that may have contributed to the breakdown of her marriage to an academic. All the horror and pity and the dilemma itself were in the photograph shown to the judge and no one else. Infant sons of Jamaican and Scottish parents lay top and tailed amid a tangle of life support systems on a pediatric intensive care bed, joined at the pelvis and sharing a single torso, their splayed legs at right angles to their spines, in resemblance of a many-pointed starfish. A measure fixed along the side of the incubator showed this helpless, all-too-human ensemble to be 60 centimetres in length. Their spinal cords and the lower ends of their spines were fused, their eyes closed, forearms raised in surrender to the court's decision.
Ian McEwan reading from his as-yet-unpublished novel, The Children Act, out in September from Jonathan Cape. Ian is a veteran of these literary confabulations, and he's a rarity in preferring to talk about work that has yet to be published rather than the books that are already out. He told me that on several occasions he's actually asked his audiences for information, the names of plants, for instance, that he has incorporated into the novel they're discussing. Helen Dunmore also enjoys meeting her readers at these festivals. Here at Charleston, she was paired with a non-fiction history of 1914, talking about her novel The Lie, set just during and after the First World War.
To me, it's very interesting if you have, say, a social historian and a novelist talking together and discussing their research and discussing how characters formed and how human experiences reflected within non-fiction and within fiction. It's very much part of an author's life these days, going to festivals. And fortunately, I enjoy it because it must be hell if you don't. And Charleston, I love coming here because of its beauty and particularly the history and the garden and so on. So it is a pleasure. Increasingly, it seems to me that reading groups come to festivals. You'll often have people come up afterwards and will say, I'm here as a scout for my reading group. We're going to read your book, or we have read your book, and we wanted to find out something from the author themselves. And I like that. I like that idea of a direct relationship between reader and writer. And the idea that, in a way, it's a shared imaginative process, because without the reader's imagination, there is no book.
This is taking place in a house that the Bloomsbury set, as they were then called, moved into in 1916, which is very much about the time that your novel is set. Do you feel those sort of resonances mean something?
There are some resonances. I'm interested in the relationship between Virginia Woolf and her sister Vanessa Bell, who lived here. That relationship between sisters and that place was the inspiration for one of my novels, but not this one. What I like about Charleston is it has evolved and transformed itself over many years. I've come here a number of times over the years, and it's a very relaxed and welcoming place where people can, they're not hassled, they're not chivied, they're not rushing from tent to tent, they are enjoying themselves, and that's really important.
Tell us a little bit about The Lie.
The Lie is a novel that follows a group, particularly three young people who come of age during the First World War, and their lives are completely transformed by their experiences in that war. And it is set in three periods: pre-war, during in France during the war, and then afterwards, looking back in early 1920. So I'm looking at the aftermath of war and then the experience and how lives were changed utterly by those times, and what it did to relationships, what it did to the very close friendships between two men who go to war together, what it did to the relationships with those at home who didn't share, couldn't share, and probably could never fully understand the experience that they had had. So for me, the fiction is about breaking the silence that often surrounded those men when they came home. They couldn't speak, and they perhaps didn't know if they could tell their story or not.
The two characters at the centre of this novel are Daniel and Frederick, and they come from very different classes. Daniel's a son of the earth. His mother was very much downstairs, had been a cook. And Frederick's father is a self-made man who's made an awful lot of money and is very unpleasant, really, isn't he?
In Daniel, we've got a young man who has not been educated beyond the age of 11. Like so many of our grandparents, he had to leave school because his wages were needed. A very talented boy, very interested in words, in language, in books. And almost comically, his dearest friend Frederick, his kind of blood brother, is going to receive an excellent, costly education and really is not interested at all. Loves to draw, loves to loves to be outdoors, loves to muck about. He's the complete opposite. But I'm also looking at a society that's changing very, very rapidly. The social transformations of the First World War are enormous. And a young man coming home from the war, possibly expecting this country fit for heroes to live in, and instead of that finding that he hasn't got his job anymore because his mother has died, his rented cottage is occupied by others. And that was true of quite a large number of returning men. So it's, how do you build a life? How do you, you've survived once, how do you survive twice?
And what Daniel finds in the war is not just the mud of the trenches, is it? It's a whole different sort of organisation that we don't often hear about in the context of the First World War.
He goes across to France. He's never been outside, probably never been outside Cornwall before. And he finds a highly organised, almost industrial process. He finds army workshops, army schools, he finds engineering, he finds communications, he finds logistical support, he finds people with a trade being encouraged to develop it in order to further the war effort. And he is overwhelmed by the sheer scale of it. He marvels the size of the troop ship, the size of the hospital ship, the process that gets him from the remote far west of Cornwall to France. And he's a very observant young man. So I wanted to show two things. One that we probably all know about, which is the chaos into which, for example, a trench raid could dissolve very, very quickly. What could be the chaos and destruction of action? And also the way a whole country, a whole society was organised, mechanised and irrevocably changed by those 4 years of war.
Helen Dunmore's The Lie is published by Hutchinson. It's already going into paperback, while Ian McEwan's The Children Act is still under lock and key. But books festivals are not always just about books, as Philippe Sands is about to demonstrate. He's an international human rights lawyer and university professor, and he's going to Hay-on-Wye with a fascinating piece of musical archaeology.
Well, it is the outshot of a book writing project. I'm finishing a book that will come out next year, which is on the lives of four men, one of whom ended up being a prosecutor at Nuremberg, the other was a defendant at Nuremberg. And in the process of working on this over 5 years, I've been gathering the various pieces of music that they loved in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. And with a friend of mine who is an opera singer, Laurent Naouri, we've created a piece which tells the story but wraps it around the music.
And so actually what this is, you said maybe the word for it is a songspiel, but not quite.
It's words and music, more in musique, and we've been trying to find the right phrase that encapsulates what it is. I tried songspiel with Laurent, and he said that was inaccurate. That was a very technical term, and I was off track, which I am with a lot of the music, because I don't have a musical background. He's been driving the music. But what's very striking about the music is that it underpins an extraordinarily powerful story, the details of which I don't want to go into right now, in which the music amplifies the words and the words provide an explanation of the music.
This is Richard Strauss collaborating with somebody who a couple of years later was to be tried at Nuremberg.
Well, one of the pieces of music that we found, I came across a very bizarre story, which surprised me, which was that one of the characters in my story is Hans Frank, who was Hitler's lawyer, Governor General of Occupied Poland from 1939, overseer of the territory on which all the concentration camps were. He was a friend of Richard Strauss's, the wonderful, famous, great composer. In 1943, Strauss had a problem, apparently. You know, they wanted to billet refugees in his house and send his driver to the front. Hans Frank intervened in 1943. To thank Hans Frank, he wrote a short piece for him, and I found the words, the lyrics. But the music had been lost. With the help of Dennis Marks and others, we tried to find the music, but the estate says it has disappeared, it has been lost.
I mean, It has been disappeared, perhaps.
I mean, it's not an ideal thing in Strauss's life, you know, to, in 1943, write a pen of thanks to such a terrible individual who is hanged just 3 years later for killing 3 million people. So what we did, Laurent has a good friend in New York, a Frenchman, a composer, a very celebrated composer, Frédéric Chasselain, and Frédéric reconstructed the music in the style of Richard Strauss, and it will be performed for the first time at the Hay Festival. The various pieces of music are all individually and independently interesting, but of all the pieces, the one that has resonated most powerfully for me was a very curious discovery that I made. Hans Frank, in the summer of 1946, facing a trial at which he was likely to lose his life, took solace in a piece of music by Johann Sebastian Bach, The Passion of Matthew. And he did so for obvious reasons, because it has a set of arias and choruses in which the theme of mercy is recited. At the very same time, one of the prosecutors, who's another character in the story, writes to his son in America. He's a prosecutor on the British team, and tells his son, his name is Hirsch Lauterpacht, he's the professor of international law at Cambridge University, that the only thing that helps him get through the day, the challenges of writing, the British Attorney General's closing arguments, dealing with the absence of news of his own family in Poland, is to listen to the Matthew Passion. And it left me with an extraordinarily complex set of feelings that the same piece of music can resonate so powerfully for prosecutor and defender in the same trial at the same moment. And one only has to listen to the music, as I have now done repeatedly, including at Bach's own church, the Thomaskirche in Leipzig, which is a remarkable place, to listen to the music in a different way when you imagine the fate of the two individuals in Nuremberg in 1946 who home in on that same piece of music for very different reasons. Lauterpacht must have focused on an aria that is called Geduld, patience. Frank, I think, but I don't know, must have homed in on an aria, the most famous aria of all, Erbarme dich, have mercy on me, my Lord. So different individuals in the same situation, but on opposite sides of the fence, so to speak, can take solace and refuge in the same music. That struck me as remarkable.
You are a trustee of the Hay Festival.
I'm on one of the boards.
You're always there. Managed to find time in this extraordinary international legal life that you have to be at Hay year after year.
I go every year, and I spend the entire period there decamping with my family, with my wife and my children. And we go to lots of events and we see lots of people. And I like going because it is a way of completely switching off from the daily challenges and traumas. It's life stops. You can't get emails down there. You can't really get through mobile phone reception. And so you're stuck in the middle of wonderful Wales. And you are just forced to go into a different place, and you talk and you think and you discuss and you sleep and you rest and you read. And it's wonderful, and it leaves you completely refreshed. I mean, there are always great people coming, and there are always unexpected moments. So I find the experience of going for a full... I'm fortunate. I can go for 10 days, and I do go, and it's exhilarating. I love it.
Philippe Sands there. The Great Crimes will be premiered at Hay this Sunday evening, May the 25th. But if you miss it there, don't worry. It's going on to London's South Bank Centre in November and to Stockholm in January. There are so many festivals that I do sometimes wonder if there are enough writers to go around. arts writer Maeve Kennedy may have some views of her own on that. She's just come back from a rather posh lunch to launch the Happy Days Festival in Enniskillen. Had to miss out on all but the starter.
Yeah, the Beckett Festival was one of those ones that has just sprung up in the last couple of years. Somebody had the brilliant idea of thinking, Beckett, there must be a connection here. And Beckett was an old schoolboy in Enniskillen, so hoopla, here comes another festival. It's a really good fun one, actually, because there's a good reason for it. There's a central thread, and it's quite tightly focused. So there are Beckett productions, art, writers who are interested in him, actors like Fiona Shaw, who was terribly interested in him talking. But I just feel that some of the festivals have just got too big and sprawly, and that personal contact, which is what the festivals were about, weren't they? They were about readers feeling that they really want to meet the writers. And Hay now is enormous, and it feels much more like one of the big rock festivals than a book festival.
Yeah, and it's interesting that they have a second festival, How the Light Gets In, which is a sort of music and ideas festival, which when we used to sponsor Hay was a tiny little thing based in one little room, and now it's got 300 events of its own on top of the great big Hay Festival.
I know. And I have to say, when you hit that stage of the year when all the festival brochures start thumping onto your desk, I just get this feeling of exhaustion. I think nobody has time to read all these books. Nobody has time to go to all these places. It tends to be the tiny little ones that I like. I mean, there's a literary festival just across the river from me in Richmond, which often has very local authors, very local books. And it's a real pleasure. You feel like, I've got to get my head around this. That sounds lovely. I'm not going to bother with that. And you can just go and do it. But some of them now, there is a feeling, isn't there? It's like the big international rock shows of a carnival that's a kind of fairground that's travelling from place to place, in which the books and the readers are almost a side effect. They're the justification rather than the core of it now.
There is something like 350, can that be true, in the course of a single year on these islands?
I think that was last year's count, so I'm not absolutely certain that that's true any longer. Yeah, when I was working in the Irish Times, there was the Merryman Festival in Ireland. There was a kind of vaguely booky bit of the Dublin Theatre Festival usually. There was Hay in Edinburgh and Oxford and Cheltenham over here, and that was about it. And now there is one pretty much on every village corner. You just wonder how many festivals can Michael Morpurgo possibly go to. And Louis de Bernier, for some reason, seems to be absolutely everywhere this year as well. And you just think, do they not need to lie down in a darkened room?
Well, there is a point in that, isn't there, that actually it does take an awful lot of time away from the writing of the next book.
Yes, absolutely. And there is completely that feeling now, isn't there, that it's all about selling the last book. It's not just about sitting down and meeting the author and talking about his wonderful life and times. It's about merchandising the last book.
Well, not in Ian McEwan's case, as we've just heard. So some writers keep faith actually with the idea of a future.
Yes. Well, I suppose you have to keep your profile up there, haven't you? If it's taking a few years to produce the next book, I suppose your publishers probably tell you you've got to put yourself out there and keep on the road.
Now, there is another pragmatic point, which is that a lot of these writers are very expensive to transport if they're coming, say, from Australia or the Arab world or something. And they can go on a sort of sharabank round all the festivals, and therefore the money that it costs to bring them over is shared, and therefore you can get
You've got to get as much out of them as possible once you've flown them over here.
Thanks, Maeve. And thanks, too, to all our fine festival performers, Ian McEwan, Helen Dunmore and Philippe Sands. Let's now move on to one of those long-haul troopers who's just touched down on these festive shores. He's Tim Winton, twice shortlisted for the Booker Prize and four times winner of Australia's Miles Franklin Award. He stopped off on his journey from Western Australia to Charleston, Bath and Hay-on-Wye to talk about his latest novel, The Eyrie.
He angled away into an oncoming torrent of pedestrians, all boiled faces and beetling sunglasses, a surge of elbows, phones, smoke puckers and semisyllables within a fug of sweat and warring perfumes. He yielded toward the road's edge where buses shuddered and gulped at the curb. A skateboarder swept past. The street pulsed and roared as he fought for a bearing. Target, pharmacy, real estate agent, bank. Fuck, he was listening, yawing, hopelessly self-correcting. It was more than he could manage. Any second, he'd capsize. So he lurched into the closest entry. Coles, safe harbour. Obedient glass doors, air conditioning, Muzak. Went deep, headed instinctively for the fluorescent headwaters. seeking cool air and cooler still, until he found himself in the produce section, staring at spears of Peruvian asparagus in slender, uniform lines of green. They were only cut vegetables, for Christ's sake, and cheap imports at that, but there was something lovely and clement about their serried ranks and pastel colour. And now that he noticed it, the entire refrigerated colonnade had over it a misty, cool sheen, cool enough to make a Celt weep, moist, clean, unending blur. Beneath the muzak, a special kind of quiet, silent gusts of respite, and such calm, such unpeopled order. He caught himself fighting the urge to lie down there in the lee of these wafting cabinets and sleep till dark, just him and poor Karen Carpenter, him and the clean pine crates and the pino-clean disinfectant and those vegetables to which clung the last faint odour of something like life itself.
So that is Tom Keeley suffering from the mother and father of hangovers.
For his sins, yes.
With which you open the novel.
It's one of those hangovers that it just clings. You feel grimy afterwards just reading it.
He's a sort of fallen man, isn't he? He has been a media personality, an environmental activist, and everything's just fallen apart on him, and that's the point at which we meet him.
Yeah, falling still yet, I think. He's really fallen out of love with himself, his life. He's lost faith in himself and lost faith in faith itself, if you know what I mean. He's just done something catastrophic, really. He's just told the truth. Something, you know, he's uttered something at a press conference, which is perfectly factually correct, but which is catastrophic to his prospects. And in the city that he's in, like all cities, there are certain things that might be true, but if you say them, you will be punished, and you know, you'll never work in that town again. He's unemployed, his marriage has gone south, he's lost the house. He almost has this sort of instinct that he wants to be punished, that he feels like such a failure, that he feels even more of a failure than what people think. He's hiding in this flat, in this really seedy 60s high-rise, in the unromantic, you know, ghastly part of town, really, that's the sort of where the down-and-outs are. And he's just marinating in his misery. But he's also in the sort of company of the people that he came from. He's a working-class boy who's been catapulted into the bourgeoisie, and suddenly he's back where he started from, and further back than from where he started. So he's just hiding from the world, just taking out divorce proceedings against his fellow humans.
The thing that changes him is an encounter with a woman that he knew when he was young, who's came from a much rougher family than he did.
Yeah, there's a sort of a chance encounter. I mean, you know, every novel needs one, I suppose. On the balcony, he just bumps into this person. He doesn't even recognise her, and he doesn't recognise the fact that she recognises him, and she has a little boy.
He almost makes a new family, which is in counterposition to his own family. He has rather sort of do-gooding parents, although his father is sort of sainted in memory, and his mother is a sort of social worker, isn't she, and a do-gooder.
Yeah.
To what extent is this a novel about the Australian family?
I wasn't very conscious of that. I was finding my way. I was following these people. Family is what you find. It's what you're left with. It's not often what you choose. It's who you find yourself with.
I could point to parts of this novel which painted a totally different story. Family is where the abuse is.
That's the circumstances that you find yourself in. I guess Kai is this boy who's sort of radiant with trauma, with having been ignored unless it was to be the subject of violence or the subject of trouble. And all the men, you can tell that all the men in his life have been malevolent, and yet he somehow recognises something in Keeley. Keeley, you know, he's full of self-disgust, sees himself as a failure, as a joke, really. And he's bewildered by this kid's attention, that this kid would choose him, which is essentially what's happened. Took me years to figure it out, but you know, the child is more or less silently saying, and then later not so silently saying, I choose you, you will rescue me.
What do you mean it took you years to work it out?
Battling away and
years of writing the novel.
Yeah, I don't set out with a program or a coherent idea. That would be way too orderly. I wish I did. So I mean, the process of writing is a little closer to the process of, you know, of discovery as a reader than, yeah, it's closer than I like to think.
So in the course of this really quite prolific career, you have put into fiction a very particular Australian landscape, which is the landscape of Western Australia, which is, it's Fremantle, isn't it?
Yeah. I didn't set out, you know, to write about the forgotten part of Australia, which is, you know, one third of the continent. But that was just where I was from. It was what I knew. It was what I loved. You know, I'm a no account person from a no account place in the wrong side of the wrong country in the wrong hemisphere. But that was all right. I mean, the ecology of social ecology and the physical ecology of where we were should be good enough to write about. I didn't feel the need to go to Sydney and from there to London or New York and write about proper people in proper places.
Mm. And this novel is set in 2007-08 when there's a financial crisis everywhere except for in Western Australia, because Western Australia has the minerals and the mining, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's the great quarry that keeps China going. And it does have that moral blindness that comes from prosperity, this sense that it confuses its good fortune with virtue, which is a sort of a line that Keeley likes to roll out with a little bit more vinegar in it. That part was probably deliberate, to have this kind of rich, smug, insulated culture of success while the rest of the world's on the brink of complete disaster. And yet, you know, the economic collapse and the malaise and the decay that's happening, that's a periodic thing that happens economically, but in the real economy, which is the material world upon which we all rest and it's what we require to survive, that collapse is happening all the time. And he knows that. He knows that the world is in free fall, that we're spending more than we've got. And what the bankers have done is just a periodic getting caught and then being rewarded for their bad behaviour. And yet what's happening in the wider, proper world is that we're all eating ourselves out of house and home and taking more than we're putting back. And that's what's driven him crazy. He's a man who's been standing in the traffic his whole professional life trying to point out the obvious, and no one wants to know.
Without talking about the ending necessarily, I mean, you could almost call it How to Be Good. It almost could be a novel-length negotiation of what it is to be a good person in a really corrupt world.
Yeah, to try to do the right thing when there's no binary. There's no choice between a good thing and a bad thing. You've only got messy things in front of you. You've got to choose between two imperfect paths, or five, you know. I think there's an impulse towards good and redemption, and I think whether Keeley is a success in that sense, people will decide for themselves. But every bit of saving, every bit of rescue, every bit of goodness, every effort for the greater good is contingent. It's partial. And you hope that there are enough people in the world who are trying to make it better, who are trying to leave something behind. There'll be enough of those small, tiny, rather forlorn and vulnerable acts of goodness that might make something bigger, that there'll be enough of that to hold against the tide.
Tim Winton. The Eyrie is published by Picador. Next week, we'll devote ourselves to the Dylan Thomas centenary celebrations. Look out also for our trip to the festival that we sponsor in Edinburgh in August. And that's all from us for this week. From me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.